Thousands of teachers and their supporters descended on Arizona's Capitol last week with a list of demands, but Governor Doug Ducey's response was less than satisfactory. The governor found himself taking heat elsewhere, too, as he continues to face questions about Uber's autonomous vehicle testing. And a group of freshman Democrats have been advised to just sit down and stop talking, but that's not advice they're willing to take. We'll be talking about all of that and so much more today on The Breakdown. I'm your host, Katie Campbell, and reporters Paulina Panetta, Carmen Foreman, and Ben Giles join me in the studio as always. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up? Katie.
Hi.
Okay. I don't know about you guys, but I really needed a break after last week. God, there was a lot going on. And as you know, I'm sure, thousands of teachers and students and parents and elected officials all marched on the Capitol last Wednesday.
Yeah, they've been doing this for a few weeks in a row, but were there any particular demands this time, Katie?
Well, so like you say, they've been observing this Red for Ed on Wednesdays for a couple of weeks now, but last Wednesday was really different. They, and when I say they, again, thousands of people showed up at the Capitol. They were like marching in this great cyclone of red around the Capitol courtyard. And it was the biggest show, single show at the Capitol, God, in a long time. I talked to some representatives that were there and they were just amazed at the number of people. I actually happened to see folks walking all the way from downtown to the Capitol because they couldn't find parking anymore. But like you say, they did have some demands. Everyone in the Capitol community knows Save Our Schools Arizona at this point, the group responsible for the referendum on the expansion of school vouchers that's scheduled to be headed to the November ballot. But there's a recent addition to the grassroots public education advocacy kind of community, and that's Arizona Educators United. That was created by a West Valley teacher, Noah Carvelis. He also happens to be a campaign spokesman for one of the folks vying for the superintendent of public instruction, but it's my understanding this is supposed to be different or at least separate from that campaign. Anyway, he was speaking on behalf of Arizona Educators United at this big rally at the Capitol last Wednesday, and he made a few pretty interesting demands. First of all, 20% raise for teachers across the board, better compensation for all education employees, an increase in per pupil funding back to a certain level, I believe maybe back to 2008 levels. So a lot of things focused on improving public school funding in Arizona.
So in addition to their demands, what else is the Save Our Schools Arizona group planning? I mean, they've been protesting, and that's obviously a show of force, but what else do they have up their sleeve in the future?
So Arizona Educators United were the ones who presented the demands, but they are kind of partnering with Save Our Schools Arizona now. And what I was told by Save Our Schools Arizona spokeswoman Dawn Pennick Thacker is not only is that community of volunteers gearing up for a possible referendum on whatever might replace the ESA expansion legislation of last session, but they're asking volunteers to be prepared to also collect signatures on some kind of initiative geared towards remedying the public education funding shortfalls. When I asked Dawn Pennick Thacker about what that might entail exactly, she said there's a lot on the table right now. It could be anything from closing corporate tax loopholes to something similar that we've seen in Proposition 301, so another kind of sales tax. There's a lot of ideas rolling around, mostly because they don't know if they're going to have to go through with a second referendum on ESA expansion. But the fact of the matter is they're having these conversations, and that could be a really interesting turn of events for the folks who maybe are resisting the demands at this point. That'll actually be really interesting for the governor, Carmen. And I know he had something of a lackluster response to Wednesday's happenings at the Capitol.
Yeah, Governor Ducey, as probably expected, pretty much said no to the 20% teacher raises. He said that he has raised teacher salaries, I think he said about 9% since he came into office in 2015. And, you know, he was getting some heat when he said something along the lines of, we are 43rd in terms of teacher pay, but at least we're not last. as reporters were grilling him outside of a Vietnam veterans event held in front of the Capitol.
Oh,
so for a man who has pledged not to raise taxes, it doesn't seem too surprising.
And that 9% figure that the governor touted last Thursday, that's actually a number that came from the School Boards Association. That's a figure that represents how much local school boards have decided to invest in teachers of what they've been given from the lawmakers at the Capitol. And only about half of that is actual raises. It was roughly 5% of that 9% is just representative of new teacher hires, which is also something that teachers and educators have been complaining about, a teacher shortage still. So only about a 4% raise overall for teachers since Ducey took office.
Well, and speaking of numbers that might be disputed a bit here, Carmen, you mentioned that he said we're 43rd, and that's something I know that's constantly brought up. Is it 43rd, 49th, 50th? What's the consensus, if any?
That 43 figure, that we're 43rd in the nation in terms of teacher pay, honestly, I see a lot of different numbers thrown out there, 43, 49, 50, and it's one that folks in Arizona, folks around the Capitol can't really decide on just solely one number and for reasons that are beyond me.
Well, delightful.
I think, you know, regardless of what where we are or where Arizona teachers are in the standings in terms of pay, it seems that teachers and Doug Ducey are now at a standstill. Teachers say they want more and Ducey says no. So I'm sure the teachers won't go away too quietly or too soon. So we'll see what happens next.
Well, and even as we say the teachers weren't satisfied with his response, you know, Governor Ducey's spokesperson, Daniel Scarpinato, kind of was on Twitter defending the response, saying that's not exactly what he said. What exactly was his beef with how the governor's response was portrayed?
His beef was that some reporters, I guess, were honing in on the part where Doug Ducey said, at least we're not last in the nation. You know, we're 43rd, but at least we're not last. The governor's spokesperson, Daniel Scarpinato, was trying to point out that he said a lot of other things in that press conference, or not press conference even, gaggle of reporters who hounded him. And he said things like, you know, I am an advocate for the teachers, I am fighting for the teachers, or I am on the teachers' side. And so I think Scarpinato felt that maybe the portrayal was sort of one-sided. Ducey appeared as this big, bad, mean wolf, you know, who's saying no to the teachers. But in reality, he said a lot more than, you know, we are 43rd, but we're not last.
So at the end of the day, I mean, from my reporting on the education front, I don't think a lot of people trust what he has to say at this point. They're not really taking his promises at face value. They're reluctant to even accept a promise in the place of real action. So it seems like the education folks don't think a lot's going to come out of this, even if they're really trying to force the governor's hand. But what do you think? Do you see any wiggle room?
If there were wiggle room, I think it's only because this has become a national movement and the West Virginia teachers, they put on pressure and the state responded. And then in Oklahoma, the teachers put on pressure and the Oklahoma legislature came to a compromise to offer a salary boost for teachers within their state and Governor Mary Fallon signed it. Of course, the teachers still say that's not enough and that they're still going to strike. But if Arizona teachers have anything right now, it's almost that they have more leverage because teachers in other states are putting the pressure on their lawmakers and they're seeing results. So maybe there is room for wiggle room.
Last week wasn't the greatest week for the governor's office. There's still questions around the incident with the Uber vehicle that struck and killed a woman and the autonomous testing program. Where do we stand on that?
So authorities are still investigating the death and what actually happened with the Uber car and the pedestrian who was walking across the street. But Ducey, in the meantime, is receiving more and more flack or more and more pressure because he was the one who years ago basically let Uber come into the state with very little oversight, essentially no regulations to follow. And so people are putting the blame on him for this pedestrian death. And even though he has basically halted Uber autonomous vehicle testing within the state, which I will point out Uber had already halted themselves beforehand. Ducey signed an order basically saying they can't test autonomous vehicles. And because of that, they can't restart testing autonomous vehicles without his consent. But publications like The Guardian and The New York Times have pointed out that Uber's autonomous testing program and within the state may have had, the company may have known of problems long before this fatal incident. The New York Times in one of their stories said that the autonomous vehicles had faced problems approximately every 13 miles. They didn't know how to handle construction zones. Wow. And driving next to tall vehicles, like if you're driving next to a tractor trailer on the highway, while the self-driving Uber cars didn't know what to do about that, just like a lot of us. So,
wow, I honestly had no idea about that. So thank you for terrifying me and maybe some other people. But you also mentioned a story by The Guardian, which caused another Twitter kerfuffle to erupt. What was the deal with that particular report? And y'all feel free to jump in on that as well. And why was it maybe more of a flop than it seemed to suggest?
The short version is that The Guardian reported that Uber had been testing these autonomous vehicles in secret in Arizona long before anyone from the governor's office or from Uber ever told the public. In actuality, that's a bit of a stretch.
Well, so what did the public know about autonomous testing in Arizona, and when did it know? Because The Guardian seemed pretty specific in their claim that a chain of emails between Uber executives and Ducey's staff made it sound like autonomous testing began in Arizona months before that became publicly known.
In August 2016, Uber started testing just a small number of vehicles, probably about five within the state, and they were mapping vehicles. And the Guardian story kind of took issue with the fact that Uber had started testing these vehicles but didn't hold a giant press announcement until probably the next year, maybe a few months later. And in that press announcement, Ducey and Uber executives all hailed the autonomous vehicle testing program. But the Guardian story said, oh, well, they had been testing these vehicles for months beforehand. But that wasn't really a secret to those of us here in Arizona. Mm. Local media had reported on the fact that Uber and Waymo had been testing these cars within the area. I think we ourselves had a story with a lead, something along the lines of, you may see these cars on the highway, but they won't have a driver in them.
Right, right.
So
it sounds to me like The Guardian just doesn't subscribe to Yellow Sheet is what this really boils down to.
Yes.
Well,
shameless self-promotion.
Don't say shameless self-promotion.
That's what it is.
Oh, God. All right. Well, like that, whatever the reason, it sounds like Uber's going to have to take a break from Arizona streets. And on that note, we, too, are going to be taking a short break. Come right back. Thanks. You know what makes a good idea great? Data. The McGuire Company has the economic research and the insight to break it down and help guide your public policy efforts to success. For decades, the McGuire Company has used their top-notch understanding of policy options and current economic trends to lead their clients to policy solutions that work. Take your policy project ideas to the next level with the McGuire Company at aemaguire.com. That's aemaguire.com. Welcome back to The Breakdown. I'm your host, Katie Campbell. And Paulina, you didn't get to talk at all in that last segment, so now it's going to be all about you and these outspoken freshman Democrat ladies, which, as you were finishing that story last Thursday, there was a pretty perfect example of why they feel they need to do what they do. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. It was part of the reason the story came in so late. Sorry, Gary. But on Thursday, the House was debating a Senate bill in Committee of the Whole, or COW, you know, our favorite word.
COW.
And the debate got pretty heated. It was a good example of freshman Democratic women speaking up and speaking out and really advocating for issues that they think are important to the constituents who voted them into office. The bill would prohibit cities and towns and counties from mandating that employers provide provide health insurance for employees. Mm. That mandate is required by Obamacare. It hasn't been repealed yet. But Republicans argued that it's bad for business. However, Democrats said that it would leave a lot of people, especially low-income families, uninsured. And that kind of led to a really heated debate on the floor. There were a lot of points of order called to try and prevent some of the Democrats from asking questions, specifically Representative Isela Blanc of Tempe. Eventually, they kind of tried to get her to stop asking questions, arguing that she wasn't asking questions. She was actually just making long-winded statements.
I bet that went well.
Which she kind of, you know, fought back against that notion. But that led the chair of the committee to then kind of preemptively warn other Democratic women as they were about to speak to make sure that they stuck to questions pertaining to the bill and that they weren't making statements. And then things got kind of really ugly after the majority leader, John Allen, accused Blanc of impugning members by, and when you call a Rule 19 on someone, you have to say the exact word or phrase that the member used to impugn other members. And okay. So in this case, she said that supporters of the bill don't care about workers in Arizona. And Allen's argued that that was questioning the motives of Republicans who were in favor of the bill. The chair ruled in his favor, and according to the rule book, the member who has been accused of impugning is supposed to sit down. They can't keep talking. And that wasn't the case. He kind of gave her a warning and said, you know, if you do it again, your privileges to speak on the floor are going to be revoked pretty much for the rest of the conversation. And that really ticked off a lot of Republicans who then argued that she should be forced to sit down and pretty much shut up.
Oh, gosh.
And from there, it just went into total chaos on the floor. It was like point of order after point of order after point of order. There was a point of protest, which I'd never heard of, but apparently is a thing. There was another accusation of impugning. And then eventually the speaker called for the question and they took a vote on the measure. And that was the first of 12 bills they were supposed to debate. And they didn't get to the rest of them. He called it quits after that and adjourned.
Really ruined their day.
Pretty much, yeah. And it was just a really good example of a lot of what the atmosphere at the House has been, not just this year, but last year. There are 25 freshman members in the House. More than a third of the members in the House are freshmen. Most of them don't have any political experience. I believe it's 13 Democrats and 12 Republicans. And of the Democrats, most of them are women. It's 8 female lawmakers. And a lot of them come from, you know, an activism background, or they're lawyers, or, you know, they just have, you know, felt like they've seen injustices or been oppressed. And this is kind of their opportunity to speak out. And despite accusations of grandstanding or political theater or efforts to quiet them.
And speaking of those efforts, I mean, you've led that story off with telling of how several of these female lawmakers have been told, just sit back, avoid talking, don't get involved because the process will work for you. And their perspective seems to be, well, when you're the minority party and the status quo isn't working, the process doesn't work for them. Is that how they feel?
Right. As part of the minority party, their bills typically don't get heard in committee and they rarely make it to the floor. So they feel that, you know, their only tool in the toolbox, as Blanc said, is their voice, is, you know, their ability to speak out. And, you know, if they can't get their own issues heard, at least they can voice their opposition or agreement in some cases to issues that are being discussed on the floor. And I spoke to a few of the Republican freshmen, Todd Clodfelter and Travis Grantham, and, you know, they acknowledge that. They're very aware that, you know, as members of the majority party, they don't have to go to those same lengths. They don't have to, you know, twist arms to the level that the Democrats do. And though they said it can be very frustrating at times because they feel it slows down the process on the floor and it leads to really lengthy debates, which I can tell you it does. You know, I've sat on the floor for hours as they just question each other. But that's their job. And that's kind of what they said, you know, like, it might be frustrating, but that's what we're all elected here to do. And, you know, for the most part, the freshman Republican are almost all men. I think there are only 2 or 3 freshman women, Michelle Udall and Becky Nutt. But, you know, for the most part, they're fairly quiet. I mean, they do bring up points on the floor. They have gotten a lot of their bills through committee and, you know, onto the Senate. But they're not as vocal or as
they don't take the same tactic,
yeah,
it sounds
they
like.
Use different tactics, and it's a different approach than the Democrats. And
So is, I mean, because you are stuck on the floor right there with them when these debates happen, do you find that these particularly outspoken Democratic women are successful, or are their tactics, you know, getting them any further?
That's tough to say. I think their tactics are different than, you know, freshmen of years past, or even, you know, more seasoned Democrats, and definitely different than those of Republicans. I'm not sure I would say they are successful. You know, Todd Clodfelter kind of said, you know, they talk and talk and talk, and like one person's made the point, they've all made the point, but no one's really listening. And I think that just shows that, like, they can ask the questions, they can make their point, but in the end, it has very little influence on the process. But for them, I think it's they do it more for, like, their constituents. And they're very active on social media, and they're live streaming each other. And so, like, they're getting the word out regardless of if it has any true impact at the legislature itself.
So while it might be annoying to their colleagues, it seems like it really serves a purpose for the people that they represent, or at least they believe that they're serving a purpose,
right.
A greater purpose.
Definitely. Speaking of Republicans and Democrats, the Republican Party has injected a lot of money into CD8, but
yes.
But Democrats haven't really done the same. They don't really feel like that district can be won. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, speaking of differing tactics, national GOP groups like the National Republican Congressional Committee and the Republican National Committee, which sounds so similar, they've pumped hundreds of thousands of dollars behind Republican candidate Debbie Lesko for door-to-door operations. I guess there was a coordinated TV buy. Politico was reporting about this and said that even the Trump people were trying to maybe get involved, although they didn't have a source for that, so I'm not entirely sure where that comes from or how that would materialize. But yeah, on the other side, the DCCC hasn't done the same thing for Dr. Hiral Tipirneni, who's the Democratic candidate. She ran away with her special election primary, just like Debbie Lesko did, but she hasn't seen the same national return on that. And for the most part, it seemed that consultants on both sides of the aisle thought the Democratic Party on the national level just has to prioritize what they see as more winnable races, and no matter how good Tipirneni may be, she's just not going to get their support. Monetarily, anyway.
But does the GOP injecting money into the election show that they're nervous in any way of losing that seat?
So I think Republicans were less willing to characterize it that way. Politico, in their headline, described it as a dumpster fire. They were trying to avoid another dumpster fire. That, of course, referring to Republicans losing in districts in like Pennsylvania and Alabama, where they really should have been able to run away with those races, and they just had really weak candidates against what was described to me as talented moderate Democrats. They were able to come in and just really take advantage of their weaknesses. But Republican consultant Ryan O'Daniel said that the Politico headline was really just clickbait. Does it say that they're nervous? Maybe. But, I mean, they kind of have reason to be. But he sees it more as them gearing up for the regularly scheduled election, which whoever comes out of the special election as the winner will still have to go through that in August and November. So he says the national Republicans are laying a groundwork right now. His Democratic colleagues, the other consultants, don't see it that way. Andy Barr said that this says to him that Republicans are scared, expletive. He says, why would they be pumping so much money into a race that they should be winning with a warm body? And I think that's a fair point. Whether they genuinely believe Tipirneni will win or not is another question. But seeing what's happened across the country, and because we're in such a weird political environment these days, you kind of have to prepare for an unlikely outcome, or what may be an unlikely outcome in a traditional cycle. You could also say the same for the Democrats, though. So the fact that they're not entering this race, they're not taking a chance on this, the writing's on the wall there. Whether we get an unlikely result in CD8, we'll see that as of April 24th. That's special general election day. So definitely be sure to follow along with me on Twitter that night and with the Arizona Capital Times online to find out who our next congressional representative is from CD8. I'm just throwing it out there. Probably fair to say Debbie Lesko's ahead right now.
Another shameless plug.
Ooh. In the can for Republicans. Biased journalists.
Oh, God. Well, those darn Republicans, they haven't got us a budget yet, Ben.
Oh, come on. Yeah, please, guys, get a budget. We're running out of time. But in all seriousness, no, we're approaching 100 days, I believe. April 20th or 21st is going to be the 100th day of session, although the 21st is a Saturday. So don't expect anything to happen that day, I hope. I've been talking to rank-and-file Republicans in the Senate these past couple weeks. There haven't been budget meetings for, I think, 3-4 weeks now. And mostly what I'm hearing from leadership is that that's because there's nothing new to talk about. You know, the Republican leaders aren't going to waste their time talking to members if they don't have anything new to report on how budget negotiations are going.
Is that normal, Ben?
To an extent, yes. This process can drag on. You know, we've seen years where the budget wrapped up in like 82 days flat. That was a pretty big outlier as far as session goes. We've seen years when the budget boils over and we're here until June. So the 100-day mark is obviously an aspiration. There's nothing in the law or in the Arizona's constitution that says you're done after 100 and you don't have any more time to do things. So I guess I wouldn't say that Republicans feel like they're under the gun, but certainly at this time of year, things start to feel a little bit unsettled if there isn't reported progress on the budget. We're done having committee hearings. There's still some bills to vote on the floor, but the longer lawmakers just have to sit around waiting to be told that, you know, there's a budget deal almost reached, the more antsy they get, the more they get fun ideas and try and resurrect old bills and do new things that sometimes leadership wish they wouldn't. So, yeah, everybody's just trying to stay calm, get a little bit of work done each day. The staff in the Senate would call that pacing yourself, and hopefully pretty soon there will start to gain some steam on the budget. And I'm just going to put it out there to anybody that's listening and might have some budget information. You can send that to Paulina and I, and we would be eternally grateful.
Yes, please.
Do it, because then you give
money,
us stuff
please.
To talk about.
Hey, yeah. That's, well, great. It sounds like it's very much up in the air. All right. Well, hopefully people will heed our call and let us know what's going on there so that we have plenty to talk about next week on The Breakdown. Thanks again for joining us for another week. I'm your host, Katie Campbell. Say bye, guys.
Send me budget docs.
Bye.
Please.